What is this now about Susan Hudson in jail? What?
She was found in contempt of court for not having sheriff's deputies bring inmates to magistrate hearings on weekends and on holidays. Mm-hmm. The court had ordered her a few months back to do so. She said no. Then they found her in contempt, and all of a sudden she said, okay, we'll start doing it. Her sentencing is coming up in the next few days. So the question is, will she be sentenced to jail time in her own prison?
Seems pretty freaking silly to do that. She can't keep the prisoners in jail, let alone herself. What? That's crazy. What are you talking about? We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of La Politique. Well, it is. I mean, what? She can't keep the people, she can't keep murderers in jail, and you expect to keep herself locked up? Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of La Politique Weekly, joins us when we come back, talk about Governor Landry here on WWL. 7:12 now, hot and humid. A couple of waves in the Atlantic or off of the coast of Africa that they're watching. I think they want them named or me. Either way, it's not going to affect us, but we are getting to that time of hurricane season where we have to start paying attention. Jeremy Alford joins us now, our friend, editor and publisher of La Politique Weekly. How you doing, Jeremy?
Hey, Tommy. Good morning.
Been doing any fishing or not?
My son and I fished just outside Miami.
Really?
This weekend. Yeah, we knocked a couple of species off the list, snook and peacock bass, and my son even chased around and caught an iguana, which are everywhere
caught
over
it?
There. He did, yeah.
I hope he let it go.
Most certainly. It was not coming home.
That's what I was thinking. No, I see you on social media fishing with your son all the time, but when you're talking about fishing off the coast of Florida, you're not talking about like buckled in a chair, big kind of fish, or are you?
No, we stayed inshore this time.
All right. Well, do you have hopes of doing that one day?
Oh, absolutely. I've done it. I've been meaning to bring him down.
Man, I'll tell you, I went on a charter trip one time, and I know that's not why you're here, but just catching redfish that are like 3 feet long, those things will wear you out. People don't realize that. Drum, the same thing. With the boat rocking back and forth, trying to reel that in. Man, you're tired. I can only imagine being buckled in a chair. All right, let's talk about Governor Landry. Been governor since January of 2024. I think sometimes, my own opinion is, from the text line that I have here, some of the stuff that he's doing, like we just talked with Matthew Boudreau about OMV, and some of the things that he's doing that are mm-hmm. good for the state, kind of get caught up with some of the social issues that he gets involved with, or cultural issues, and President Trump, et cetera, which can be a lightning rod. But tell me about, all of that aside, substantively, what is Governor Landry doing as it relates to state government?
Look, I think the biggest story coming out of Jeff Landry's office is the unprecedented scope at which they are reshaping the footprint of state government. And Tommy, you may remember, and I looked it up, roughly a year ago, you and I discussed this very topic. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we get to follow up on it, because I think once Jeff Landry leaves office, one thing that most rank and file voters are going to realize, and may even be a hallmark of his administration, is just how much and how quickly government has changed under Jeff Landry in less than 2 years into his first term. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've seen this much change this quickly in 51 years, going back to when we ratified our current Constitution. And, you know, Jeff Landry's going about this a few different ways. He's doing this through a mix of unilateral actions, such as executive orders and board appointments, and also through legislation that the House and Senate have been pushing through for the past 2 years. I made a little list, Tommy, Landry has upended the status quo at agencies and departments across the state. We're talking about civil service, mm-hmm. economic development, ethics compliance, emergency management, natural resources, public safety, social services, transportation, workforce development. The list goes on and on. We're talking about offices that are being merged, agencies that are changing names, boards that are being completely transformed. And it's pretty incredible to watch. It would take us probably, you know, an entire hour show to go through it, you know, step by step. But the big picture is that, you know, Jeff Landry, in very short order, has upended the status quo. He is reshaping state government. He's making that footprint smaller, which is a kind of a hallmark, of course, of Republican politics. And it's all happening incredibly quickly, some publicly, some kind of behind the scenes. But we're looking at a completely different look for state government And I think by the time most people realize the kind of breadth of this, that it's going to be easier to see in hindsight.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to, and you talked about, we talked about it a year ago, I wish I could remember what I did last Friday, Jeremy, but when the governor ran, did he run on this kind of platform? I'm trying to think. Or I guess the other question is, where did the vision for all of this come from? Was this part of the platform, or is this something that the governor firmly believes? Is somebody or organizations urging him to do this?
You know, I think to the extent that Jeff Landry said that he was going to come in and shake up the status quo, that's what he promised voters. But we never saw an actual blueprint. We didn't know that he was going to pass legislation to give himself the power to name the chairs of boards where the majority of the members are his appointments. And Tommy, that's 150 boards around the state. He's reshaped the ethics board, the public defender board. Of course, y'all know that the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, his next big target is civil service. But, you know, in those first few months of Jeff Landry being in office, we saw all these articles in The Advocate and elsewhere comparing him to Huey Long, how he's on a fast track. And we're starting to see that now. And no one else knows that better than New Orleans. You know, Jeff Landry has taken an eye to New Orleans. He created a whole state police troop there. We're starting to see the crime statistics bear that out. And I think that's one of the growth areas, Tommy, what he did with Troop NOLA. I think we're going to start to see that start to expand and maybe even see some similar crime fighting efforts in other parts of the state as well.
When it comes to long-lasting changes, it seems like he's made the governor's office a whole lot more powerful by statute, and as a result, I don't see any future governor giving that power back, right? I mean, this seems like a forever change, or am I missing something?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. The legislature has taken incredible steps to give him greater power, especially over boards and commissions, and that's an incredibly powerful place to be. You know, there have been studies before that suggest that Louisiana's governor is really no more powerful or less powerful than any other governor in the nation, mm-hmm. kind of right in the middle. But most certainly, Tommy, just in less than 2 years, Louisiana's governor has kind of moved up in those ranks and has become more powerful than in the past. And, yeah, no governor in his right mind is going to want to give that up unless we see some type of, you know, big kind of good government ethics wave, which – you know, we do see that pendulum kind of swings back and forth, and we get the Buddy Romers and the Bobby Gentles in there.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk about Jeff Landry himself, because I don't know the man. I never met him. I think I spoke to him one time during a hurricane. But this has got to be one shrewd man when it comes to politics. And he presents himself kind of simply. I don't mean that in a negative way at all. I really don't. He's not a slick car salesman or anything like that, I don't think. I think he's a down-to-earth kind of guy. But he's got to know his politics when it comes to getting things done behind the scenes. And we'll go a little bit into that, if we can, with Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of La Politics Weekly, talking about how Governor Landry has made the office of governor a lot more powerful and is going to stay that way for some time to come, unless a future governor says, no, I don't want the power, and gives it back, which I don't see likely. 720, you got questions, 504-260-1870. It's the Corner Jeweler Talk and Text Line. I'll pass them along. We come back. Traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jeremy Alford, editor and publisher of La Politics Weekly, angler extraordinaire. I was asking you about Jeff Landry before, and I got to thinking about, I can't imagine Jeff Landry heading off to Vegas or cavorting with younger women, right? And that brings me to Edwin. To Edwin, you can't. You just can't. That's not him. And that brings me to Edwin Edwards, vastly different styles, but similar in terms of wielding power and getting things done, Jeff?
Jeremy? I think similar in centralizing power and recognizing the needs and wants of people and how to achieve those ends. And look, I think Jeff Landry, a good example might be, Jeff Landry is an ambitious politician who walked into state government and made a bunch of changes. And it's kind of like having a very creative interior designer who is ADHD walking into a home and, you know, saying, walk in the door for the first time, see the living room, say, we're going to redo the floors, redo the furniture, and once they're pulling up the floors, he's already in the kitchen remodeling that and looking at the bathrooms, and there's all these different projects. I mean, you know, there's a new office being formed at the Transportation Department, Tommy. Mm-hmm. The Department of Natural Resources right. is about to be renamed, and it's going to be a new office. The Ethics Board is undergoing changes. The Homeland Security is being gobbled up by National Guard. Anywhere you look in state government, there are dramatic changes happening.
I did get a text about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, a couple of them. How much political power did it take to get that done? And I don't know. I guess history will show if it's in the best interest of the state or not.
Yeah, and you know, there's a tremendous amount of money at play. You know, I think there's still some unanswered questions there. And yeah, I mean, this is a massive kind of record breaking project that was just stopped in its tracks. You know, yet another example of Jeff Landry kind of getting into the mix and taking on these big issues. But you know, there were already some kind of high powered politicos who were raising red flags over that, starting with and including Billy Nungess, the mm-hmm. lieutenant governor. So, you know, those kind of dominoes are already being set up to be tipped over.
So when it comes to insurance, you know, he takes this trip with the Speaker of the House. I don't want to start naming names because I'm going to get it wrong. With Gordon McKernan, I think, was the guy before the session started. I don't know if anything's going to change as far as car insurance and trial attorneys. Take me through all of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a tough issue for Governor Landry, because traditionally Republican governors can find business and industry in their corner. Business and industry traditionally on these insurance issues squares off against the trial bar. But Jeff Landry's trying to kind of be friends with both and to serve two masters. And a lot of folks in business and industry aren't happy about that. But that's the stance Jeff Landry has taken. In short, Tommy, you know, I've been watching this for more than two decades. Mm-hmm. I have very little hope, very small expectations that anything substantive is going to happen on insurance reform, whether it's property or auto, especially when you're talking about something that's going to benefit just us, the consumer. You know, if anything, maybe the legislature and the governor try to offer insurance businesses more incentives and more money to come here and write policy. We tried that before. We tried that last term. Didn't seem like it did much to move the needle. So, it's, you know, I think it's one of these perennial issues for now that we're just not going to see a whole lot of movement on.
Well, we only have 30 seconds left. What do you think Jeff Landry's looking at next? You talked about being in a different room before. Like, you know, we're in this room. He's in that room. What room is he in now?
And he's in the room with law enforcement and crime. And I think what we saw with Troop NOLA, we're going to be hearing more about those kind of accomplishments and where to build off of that next.
Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it. Jeremy Alford, editor, publisher of La Politics Weekly. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, about some canceled plans for a large-scale wind farm in federal waters, including some projects off of Louisiana's coast. 7:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. You know, you think that Jackson Hole store would be good news for the people of Jackson Hole, but it's really not, because they're being priced out of the area. They can't afford to live there.
And not only that, that's a lot of pristine land up there, people building on it. I'd imagine some of the natives are going to get restless pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, yeah, I've seen stories about it. They just can't afford to live there. Along those lines, I saw some real estate transactions and a piece of property in Grand Isle going for $439,000. And
really?
I guarantee you, that's not a local in Grand Isle, that's
wow.
with a piece of property, $439,000. I don't know anything about it other than what I saw in the transactions, but that's my concern with Grand Isle as well, that all the locals get pushed out, and the only people that are there are millionaires that can afford to self-insure. We'll take a break and come back, talk to Greg Upton, speaking of offshore, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, about offshore wind farms. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. 7:45, quarter till 8, Coleman in for Tim Zimmer today. Doing a good job with the bumper music as we talk about offshore wind energy. See, because you're trying, Coleman. I like that. You're trying. You're making an effort.
I appreciate it, Tommy.
Tim Zimmer, look up Wally Pipp and Joe DiMaggio. That's all I'm saying. Greg Upton joins us now, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. How you doing, Greg?
Doing good. Good morning, Tommy.
You know the story of Wally Pipp and Joe DiMaggio?
I do not.
I think it was Joe DiMaggio. Wally Pipp was hurt, and Joe DiMaggio took his place, and Wally Pipp never got back. Let's talk about, but I might have my baseball players confused. Who knows? Let's talk about wind energy, because as soon as you say wind or alternative energy, it becomes political, and some people say, well, it's never going to go. And it's not about replacing oil. It's about monetizing this for Louisiana, correct?
Yeah, so that there are definitely folks trying to monetize it. So a little history of kind of what's happened over the last few years and kind of where we are today, and of course some of the federal actions that happened last week with offshore wind. The federal government under the Biden administration was really trying to get offshore wind going. Part of that was the leasing process itself. So just like we lease offshore oil and gas here in the United States, and of course we do in the Gulf of America, we've done it for decades, the federal government's been making a push to do offshore wind leases for potential wind production in federal waters as well. And so there's a lot that goes into that. You designate these wind energy areas for potential development, and then you go through that regulatory process. And so we saw that moving forward, and there are several projects not in the Gulf of America, but up in the Northeast that are actually under construction or have just come online over the last year or so that have been a result of that process. At the same time, we had the Inflation Reduction Act, which extended those tax credits for offshore wind, which, of course, impacted the economics as well. The Trump administration has come in, and you might remember on the first day he came in, he signed a bunch of those executive orders. And one of those was a temporary withdrawal of all areas from the OCS from offshore wind leasing, and then a review of those federal leasing guidelines that happened at the same time. And then on July 7th, he did an additional executive order entitled Ending Market Distorting Subsidies for Unreliable Foreign-Controlled Energy Sources, which, of course, wind was a big target of that. And then last week, he came out in the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM. They announced that they're rescinding all designated wind energy areas from the OCS. And so what that really does is it says that the federal government, for all intents and purposes, is not going to move forward with future lease sales for wind at this time. And so the projects that are currently under construction, and there are two, one in Massachusetts and one in Virginia, those, of course, will move forward. They've already gotten through that process. Mm-hmm. But for new projects, it's probably not going to happen moving forward at this point.
So how does this compare when it comes to, like, wind farms? You know, you go to East Texas, and God knows you see miles and miles and miles of windmills, probably at other places throughout the country as well. I'm not driven through places like that lately. How does that compare with the amount of energy that could have been generated with the wind farms on land?
So an individual wind farm that's offshore will produce more electricity for a comparable size when onshore.
Say that part again, Greg.
So a wind farm that is offshore, mm-hmm, will produce more energy for its size, if you will, per capacity is what we say, but mm-hmm, think of the same size is an onshore one.
Okay.
And the reason the offshore one is more productive is because, number one, the scale of it, you can actually build these larger turbines because of just physically getting them there. You have this constraint of actually moving this equipment on land versus on the sea. But the other is because there's this what's called wind shear. And essentially, when the wind blows, when there's less friction at the surface, mm-hmm, that means that you get more wind. And of course, offshore, there's very little friction, right? It's just ocean for miles and miles and miles. Or on land, you've got trees and hills and these kind of things. And so, there's definitely a lot of potential growth for onshore wind in the U.S. We went from essentially no onshore wind 25 years ago to today, about 10% of the U.S. electricity comes from onshore wind. So that's been an enormous growth in one source. Offshore wind, we're still, we just have a few projects that are there. And so we were kind of projecting that was probably going to grow over the next decade or so. But given these actions, less likely to do so.
Let me take a break. We come back. We'll talk about how far offshore are these things. And it seems like a lot of people get all spun up about wind just because it's not traditional or it's new. And I'm just thinking, if this is way offshore where nobody's ever going to see it anyway, why would you really care? But maybe you can answer that when we come back. Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, is an economist, also about what effect will it have on Louisiana. Because I know Schwess built the boat that was going to service the wind field in Massachusetts. Greg, am I hurting myself here? Is that right?
That is correct. Yep.
Okay, so does that now put the kibosh on anything else that would happen as far as development here in Louisiana? 751, 9 till 8, traffic, WWL. 757, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, about the Trump administration canceling the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management leases in federal waters for wind farms. Did I get that right?
Pretty much, yep.
For the most part, okay. So I can remember visiting the family after Katrina in Texas and seeing these trucks with these big, giant white things. And at that time, I had no earthly idea what they were. Come to find out, they were blades for the wind turbines, right? So when it comes to people getting spun up about wind energy, and somebody texted in and saying, it's amazing how some people can be very conservative and embrace, what do you call them? Musk's cars.
EVs?
Oh, Tesla.
Teslas.
Yeah, EVs.
Against wind energy. People get spun up about this. And how far offshore are these things? Are any of us likely to ever see them or not? Because it would seem like you'd be more upset seeing it off of the road or the interstate than you would, although it's on private property, than you would out in water. Thoughts?
Yeah, so these are much larger than offshore platforms for oil and gas. Mm-hmm. And so unlike offshore oil and gas infrastructure that you're really unlikely to see, unless, of course, you're going out there fishing to go there specifically, mm-hmm. These offshore wind farms, they really are visible from shore. So I just looked up the South Fork, the one in Rhode Island that just became operational this last year. Mm-hmm. It's about 19 miles from shore. Mm-hmm. And you need to get about 30 to 40 miles away for it to be completely non-visible from shore.
So I'm guessing if you do that, then you have a problem with losing power as you transmit it back to where it has to go?
So it's actually not as big of a problem with the distance for the transmission. It's more of a problem for the expense of it. It gets deeper, so you have to deal with, you know, the deeper water. It's very expensive to build the transmission inland. So in terms of the distance, yeah, you could transport the power there, but moving deeper and deeper and further offshore gets much more expensive.
All right, so let's talk about the economics of it. I'm all for monetizing this. But if the government's subsidizing it, are we really monetizing it, or are we just getting government subsidies? Is there a future for wind energy in terms of efficiency, and is it the way to go?
Without the tax credits that were just rescinded by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, mm-hmm. I think it's going to be tough to make offshore wind economics work in the U.S. right now.
So in that case, the marketplace would say, no, the technology's not there. Accurate or not?
Sure, that's fair. I mean, the technology's there. You can do it. It's just going to be a little bit more expensive, I think, than some of the other sources of power.
But not cleaner, but not profitable without the tax credits.
That's correct.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, J.P. Moreau. We come back.